This is the August 1999 edition of Functional Medicine Update, Volume 18, Number 8. Our theme this month is on brain function. We will feature a number of reports regarding brain health issues. Our interview will be with Dr. Sydney Baker, discussing the gut-brain relationship. We will complete this edition with two reports: intestinal permeability and liver disease, and chronic stress and GI distress. Here is Dr. Jeffrey Bland and the August 1999 Functional Medicine Update.
Welcome to Functional Medicine Update for August 1999. This is a very special month for me because I have the chance to honor our clinician of the month this month that you're going to be hearing from on side two. And I just want to get you ready, kind of pique your interest and get your mind prepared for what I think will be an exciting adventure as our clinician talks about his 40-plus years of experience in medicine and how it relates to the evolution of functional medicine. But before we get to that, let me tell you what the theme of this month's Functional Medicine Update is. It's going to be talking about the non-deterministic view of our health, the post-Mendelian view of how our genes relate to our health patterns, both in infancy, youth, adolescence, young adulthood, and in maturation into older age years. And I hope that this model will derive from it a very strong clinical utility, with the specific emphasis this month and actually moving on into next month, the September issue of Functional Medicine Update, around modification of brain chemistry function and how that interrelates with the remediation of problems that can be as far-ranging as attention disorder, hyperactivity disorder, to autism, to certain types of central nervous system disorders in older age individuals. So this is the functional medicine model applied to the neuronal plasticity argument. Well, some of you know that medicine as applied to older age individuals is being looked at very, very strongly right now. And in fact, there is an extraordinary editorial that I thought was a call to action that appeared in the New England Journal of Medicine recently, volume 340, page 1283 in 1999, entitled Geriatrics and the Limit of Modern Medicine. The author of this editorial, who clearly has some very insightful comments to make about this present state of medicine, Dr. James Goodwin, who, by the way, we have quoted in his previous articles on the tomato effect, and most recently a very eloquent article in the Annals of Internal Medicine on why nutritional medicine has been resisted by traditional medicine over the last several decades. Dr. Goodwin goes on to say, like a number of geriatricians, he's come to believe that modern medicine does not work well for old people. There are three areas that are particularly problematic for old people. Number one is the medicalization of everyday life. Number two is the primacy of diagnosis. And number three is the reimbursement problems related to medical care. Medicalization, he goes on to say, is not limited to behavior. New physical illnesses have been created. These proto-illnesses require then something to be done for them. High blood pressure is a proto-illness, as are osteoporosis, high cholesterol, aortic aneurysms, colonic polyps, and carotid artery stenosis. Critics of medicalization face a serious difficulty. There are clear truth embedded in medicalization. It is true that some children have difficulty sitting still in a classroom and respond well to early recognition of the problem. It is true that treatment of high blood pressure and osteoporosis has averted much morbidity. Thus, the benefits of medicalization are clear. Unfortunately, so is the harm. It's been argued that with medicalization, the role of the physicians has become so expanded and technologized that we fail at our most important task, providing relief from suffering, goes on to say Dr. Goodwin. He goes on to say the primacy of diagnosis. What if we find a pathology wherever we look, such as the case with the very old? Is hiatal hernia still a disease if three-fourths of women in their 80s have one? And so he goes on to talk about putting a diagnosis on everything forces us to treat, and forces us to treat leads to over-medicalization, which then has an effect upon reimbursement for medical care and utilization of services. He says, for several years, I ran a large geriatric program in a university-affiliated hospital. In my more cynical moments, I saw the hospitalization of my patients as a complicated feeding process. The various specialists would come around and perform their procedures, feeding for Medicare. Now reimbursement is being turned on its head, moving from fee for service to capitation and from overtreatment to undertreatment. Surely the most profound result of this transformation is the demonstration of the degree to which medical decision-making is dependent on reimbursement. If we teach only what we know, and if we know only what we can measure in clinical trials, then we can say little of importance about the care of the elderly, because we really don't know that much from clinical trials as to how to manage them properly. He goes on to say that more important than a new model is the need to bridge the gaping chasm between what we do and what we know to be true. It is disturbing how many of my middle-aged colleagues in academic medicine have horror stories regarding the medical care of their parents or in-laws. These anecdotes should be listened to. Their collective weight may be as close as we get to a documentation of the failure of modern medicine with respect to the elderly. Anecdotes and individual opinions are maligned in modern medicine. We demand data, the products of scientific inquiry. But data do not convey values, and the practice of medicine is about values. We need to tell more stories and to think and talk to each other about what the goals of medicine are and what they should be. End quote from Dr. James Goodwin. A very interesting start for this month's Functional Medicine Update when we asked the question, how much of disease through different age transitions is either preventable or able to be remediated on the basis of a new model, the model that we're calling the Functional Medicine Model. The Annals of Internal Medicine in the June 1, 1999 issue had a very interesting editorial talking about genes. Is there reason to change our behavior? Several major factors, including nutrition, nutrient partitioning, dietary intake, physical activity, environment, interact to contribute to the development of disease. Each factor is influenced by our genotype. For example, cross-sectional and longitudinal studies show that familial resemblance in adiposity and adoption in twin studies offer clear evidence of a genetic component in human obesity. It is estimated that 40 to 70% of within-population variation in obesity is hereditable. However, unfortunately, readers too often mistakenly interpret such reports of high heritability estimates as an indication that genes play a deterministic role in causing obesity, independent of the environmental factor and behaviors. In contrast, behavioral geneticists have provided mathematical expressions indicating the important role of environmental and behavioral factors in determining body weight despite the fairly high heritability of relative body weight. Our genes can create an energy imbalance and influence a variety of health-related problems. They can do so by contributing to the susceptibility of malnutrition or overnutrition, or they can do so through the susceptibility of altered nutrient-metabolic relationships. However, what we can see emerging is the recognition that it's the matching of genes and environment that gives the outcome of the patient's phenotype, which ultimately leads them on into disease. If someone is genetically predisposed, is he or she predestined to become diseased? We now see that there are a number of papers from adiposity and diabetes and cancer and heart disease that contribute to our understanding of this particular question by examining the relationship of environment to genes and the outcome is a phenotype in disease. With regard to adiposity, the strength of various studies lies in the use of co-twin case-control designs, in which the investigators assume that monozygotic twins have essentially 100% concordance in their genetic makeup. Within twin pairs, they found that the twin who reported being more physically active was generally less obese than the more sedentary sibling. Furthermore, the investigators identified people who were genetically prone to obesity on the basis of having an overweight identical twin. Even in this group of genetically high-risk, obesity-prone people, greater physical activity was associated with lesser degrees of obesity. One cannot deduce from this cross-sectional study whether greater physical activity caused the lower body weight or whether having a lower body weight was conducive to being more physically active, because obesity-prone people seem to become more spontaneously active after they lose weight. However, an important implication of this study is that physical activity is likely to help prevent obesity regardless of one's genetic predisposition. In summary, modern society may offer the perfect environment for the expression of genetic proclivities. It makes it easy for an individual to be sedentary, especially when one is predisposed to such behavior. It may well be that genetic variants that were previously important for survival but were phenotypically silent in terms of diseases may now, in the presence of permissive environment, contribute to illness. The combination of our genetic makeup and the current environment poses a challenge as to how to control our disease. In fact, subsistence in modern societies requires adaptations in dietary and physical activity behaviors that most people find difficult to achieve in an environment of luxurious calories and a promotion of sedentary lifestyles. However, whether we stay lean or become obese is ultimately determined not by our genes alone, but by the environment mixing with our genes to give rise to certain outcome. That's a recent quote from the Annals of Internal Medicine, which I think frames the nature of the functional medicine model. Taking our genetic messages and trying to have them expressed in ways by modifying our environment that give rise to high-level wellness or compression of morbidity 7, 8, 9, or 10 decades. What we're really talking about is genetic uniqueness, as you've heard in the past. Functional medicine is built around the concept of a unique genotype, biochemical individuality. And it was very exciting to see in the recent issue of the Wall Street Journal Marketplace Section B, the title of a front page story, New Era of Personalized Medicine, Targeting Drugs for Each Unique Genetic Profile. Those of you that have been subscribers to Functional Medicine Update for many years recall that we talked some 8 years ago around the concept of genetic polymorphisms related to the detoxification liver enzyme profiles, the so-called cytochrome P450 isoforms and the phase 2 conjugation enzymes. We even made the prediction that sometime in the future, based upon this information, medicine would be practiced differently because atypical drug reactions are probably not atypical, but typically reproducible in individuals who have the inability to properly metabolize or to manage certain medications based upon their unique genotype. Little did I know when that prediction was made some 8 years ago that come 1999, the pharmaceutical industry, which makes $1 billion a year selling one-size-fits-all medicines, would be actually transitioning itself to come up with tailor-made drugs that will treat people based upon their individual genetic makeup. Drug companies now hope to create a map of genetic landmarks that will become a potent new tool for uncovering the minute inborn differences that make some individuals particularly susceptible to certain diseases, goes on to say the Wall Street Journal. With that knowledge, the drug makers hope to develop safer, more potent drugs that can more precisely target the variety of biological quirks that underlie each major disease. Their goal, a cornucopia of personalized medicines that will produce huge profits for the next century. One of the most important things going on right now in human biology is deciding on how to distinguish the large group of genetic variability among individuals that is being recognized, says Dr. John Keller, Vice President and Director of the Alliance of Technology at SmithKline Beecham. Already several drug makers, including Bristol-Myers Squibb, Roche Holdings, and Novartis, are using a small number of genetic signposts currently available to fine-tune the delivery of existing drugs in an attempt to increase their effectiveness. So I think you can see that we're watching the emergence of a personalized medicine based upon biochemical individualities, not one-size-fits-all vanilla 70-kilogram white Anglo-Saxon Protestant male medicine. We're looking at individualized medicine, and that may relate back to what Dr. Goodwin talks about in his concept of a healthcare system for older age individuals that meets their needs, and not forget that the objective is to treat individual patients in unique ways. While there's no place in the body probably with a greater diversity of genotypic expression to phenotypic outcome than that of the nervous system. So if we were to apply this model of personalized treatment to central nervous system disorders, starting off in infancy and going through the developmental cycle and into age-related neurodegenerative disorders, we might come up with a whole new model of treatment than that of wait for the diagnosis and treat, the medicalization and the primacy of diagnosis model that has been dominant in our medical technology for the last 50 years. In Science Magazine, Volume 284, page 96 in 1999, an article entitled Complexity in the Nervous System describes the advances in neurosciences which have revealed the staggering complexity of even simple nervous systems. This is reflected in their function, their evolutionary history, their structure, and the coding schemes they use to represent information. What we're talking about is brain complexity, redundancy, plasticity, ability to transfer functions from one region of the central nervous system to another, and how that interrelates then to a web-like holographic model of the nervous system, not a linear reductionistic model, which has been the way that has often been taught through our studies, and therefore the way that nervous system disorders have been treated, as if it was a single point of dysfunction requiring a single intervention for its management. So let's use an example in the form of schizophrenia. Schizophrenia really would better be called schizophrenias, a plural, because there are many different variants of altered brain chemistry that may result in the phenotype that is diagnosed as schizophrenia. one of those paths of understanding of schizophrenia that is emerging from neurochemistry and neurobiology is the recognition that there is an alteration in some schizophrenics in the neuronal membrane NMDA receptor site activity, N-methyl D-aspartate. And this is a receptor site on the surface of a membrane of a neuron, which is an activation receptor site, whereby NMDA or glutamate or glycine present at the right time and place and concentration, an excitation of the neuron can occur. It then causes a change in ion channel uptake of calcium. This leads then to an alteration in intracellular function and actually alters mitochondrial oxidative phosphorylation. This particular process in schizophrenics has been found to be defective, and sometimes there is an suboptimal activation by activating agents at the NMDA receptor site. This is described in some length in a very nice review article that appeared in Scientific American, the March-April 1999 issue, entitled Glutamate and Schizophrenia. There are compelling reasons now to question the longstanding notion that schizophrenia results from excessive dopamine activity in certain brain regions. Antipsychotic drugs, as you know, often block dopamine receptors, are not always helpful in managing schizophrenia because there are certain forms of schizophrenia that are not related to this problem at all. Blocking glutamate receptors with phencyclidine, for example, induces a behavioral state not unlike that seen in schizophrenia. In fact, glutamate abnormalities underlie certain types of schizophrenia, according to this more recent research. And therefore, selective upregulation of NMDA receptor sites could be of value in managing patients with this type of schizophrenia. How, then, does one go about upregulating the activity of NMDA receptor sites in individuals who have this problem? Well, a paper that was published this last year, 1999, in the journal Biological Psychiatry describes a clinical trial in the use of a simple amino acid, glycine, to upregulate the expression of NMDA receptor sites in certain schizophrenics that are non-responsive to traditional medications, antipsychotic medications, antischizophrenic medications, and in so doing produced significant improvement in their function. This was giving 6,000 to 10,000 milligrams, as high as 30,000 milligrams total, so 6,000 to 10,000 milligrams 3 to 4 times a day. And what was found in this particular treatment program is that that upregulated the NMDA receptor site in individuals who had downregulated excitation pathways in their neurons. Now, this is a pretty remarkable observation, if you'll think about it for a second, because glycine is the simplest of all amino acids. It's not even a chiral amino acid. The R group, the functional moiety on the amino acid backbone, is a hydrogen, so it can't even exist in an optically active form. It's been considered throughout most of metabolic and nutritional history as being a free currency type of molecule that can be made by deamination, transamination from many other carbon and nitrogen precursors, and therefore you would never have need to worry about glycine sufficiency. But in the case where an individual may have this NMDA receptor site insufficiency, the therapeutic use or nutritional pharmacological application of glycine then can become like a conditionally essential nutrient, meaning that it can cause upregulation to occur in a function that at the level of activity in that individual with their own genotype is unable to perform at adequate levels. Obviously, this is a very significant example of personalized medicine, using nutritional pharmacology to tailor the needs to that of the individual's genotype, to produce a new phenotypic outcome. I find this a fascinating result because in these individuals who have that variant form of schizophrenia, the therapeutic administration of oral glycine may have a very powerful benefit in the absence of any expensive patentable drug which has altered other and secondary side effects. We're looking at that of glycine as a conditionally essential nutrient for individuals with that genetic variant. That concept is further amplified in a Nature Neuroscience discussion about NMDA receptor transmission and schizophrenia and genetic variants and so-called NR2A subunits of a neurotransmitter binding. And again, the emergence from this neurochemistry research is that these unique genotypes that are then reflective under consuming diets and living the, quote, common lifestyle may then be seen as aberrant chemistries of the brain which produce then dysfunctional behavior. The same thing holds true with regard to the visual cortex and how that interrelates to NMDA receptor activity. I'm now citing from Nature Neuroscience Volume 2, page 352 in April of 1999. But when we examine the molecules that relate then to the altered brain expression, brain function, the so-called neuropeptides and small molecules that are neurotransmitters, we recognize that there's a very significant genetic diversity from individual to individual in how these molecules are secreted, how their receptor sites are activated and receive the message. And a good example of that is a very common neurotransmitter, and that's the monoamines and their detoxification enzyme, monoamine oxidase. A wonderful review in the Annals Review of Neuroscience in 1999, page 197, discusses monoamine oxidase from genes to behavior. We all recognize that if you put a person on a monoamine oxidase inhibiting drug, that you will then run the risk of that person becoming sensitive to red wine, to cheese, to chocolate, to bananas, because in so doing, the amount of monoamines that are present naturally in certain foods can no longer be detoxified, and these are vasoactive and may produce then vasodilation, which then can produce headaches. So the package insert on a monoamine oxidase drug says, tell the patient not to consume these amine-containing foods, like tyramine-containing foods, because they may produce adverse symptoms. Well, that's an extreme example of a pharmacological inactivation of monoamine oxidase. But what about people that buy just the genetic luck of the draw, their monoamine oxidase A or B isoforms are less active than other individuals, and therefore they become genetically susceptible to constituents in foods that other individuals could normally detoxify without having taken any drugs whatsoever. Now think of what that means. What that means is that natural substances in certain foods then for that person are like a drug and can produce adverse side effects. And for those individuals, it's either increase the activity of monoamine oxidase or decrease the consumption of foods that contain those vasoactive compounds. Well, if you look at then the range of evolution of monoamine oxidase enzyme over time and the genetic variation of monoamine oxidase A and B in different individuals, you can find that there, both in animal studies and in humans, a very significant range of difference in function with how they detoxify epinephrine or norepinephrine, the dopamine, the catecholamine family of neuroactive substances. And so for one individual, a response to a stimulus might produce a certain effect, both in terms of output of amines, the catecholamines, and their transmission of a message, and it may sustain the effect longer because of differing activities of monoamine oxidase, the detoxifying enzyme systems. This view of how people respond to their environment is the basis of a functional medicine, personalized medicine approach, and leads us to read signs and symptoms in a slightly different way, not as dysfunctional states, but as markers for unique genotypes that then steer us towards modification of that person's environment, nutrition, lifestyle, in such a way as to improve outcome. And in this case, we're talking about cognitive outcome or nervous system function. Obviously, this model pertains to neurodegenerative disorders like Parkinson's disease, where it's been clearly identified that there are certain genetic variants that increase the relative risk to Parkinson's, particularly in light of the extraordinary research over the last 20 years on the environmental toxin theory related to Parkinson's disease. We now recognize that there may be substances that are neurotoxic and, if not properly detoxified, may lead to nigrostriatal neuronal loss of function. Recall that Parkinson's is generally diagnosed after 70 to 80% of the dopamine-secreting neurons have been lost from the brain. So it's a fairly late-stage diagnosis relative to the increased loss of organ reserve. It would be much better if we could early on recognize the risk that that person might have to the accelerated loss of nigrostriatal neurons and do something to modify their risk. Part of that risk is related to the exposure to toxins, and another part is related to the detoxification of those toxins. This is evidenced in the review article in the Annual Reviews of Neuroscience, volume 22, page 123 in 1999, entitled Etiology and Pathogenesis of Parkinson's Disease, in which they talk about the oxidative stress, quote, brain on fire that occurs as a consequence of uncoupling of mitochondrial function in the nigrostriatum and the formation of Lewy bodies, these oxidant stress byproducts from mitochondrial uncoupling due to poor detoxification and increased toxicity of substances at the mitochondrial level that then lead to the loss of electrons as oxidizing agents that create damage to the mitochondria and ultimately to the cell. So now we're talking about how to develop a comprehensive program based upon genetic risk factors that would improve detoxification, reduce oxidative stress, and stabilize mitochondrial function. It's a very different approach then to prevention of neurodegenerative diseases than waiting for a diagnosis and then trying to move in with DOPA replacement therapy. We recognize that the brain has a very, very strong ability to modify its function based upon the state of the environment. Some people call this a brain or neuronal plasticity. Loss of hippocampal function, which we associate with Alzheimer's disease, and loss of acetylcholine secreting ability of the hippocampus, also has plasticity. Stress of a chronic nature may increase the damage to the hippocampal region and create then loss of reserve from the plasticity of the hippocampus. Again, I'm quoting from a very interesting paper talking about glucocorticoids, the stress hormones, and the interrelationship they have to excitatory amino acids, and again, the NMDA receptor sites of the hippocampus, and how that can lead to premature apoptotic cell death of neurons that we associate with increased risk to neurodegeneration, brain aging, so to speak. Dr. Robert Sapolsky, professor of neuroscience at Stanford University Medical School, was a presenter at our 6th International Symposium on Functional Medicine in Tucson, Arizona. His tour de force presentation, and I urge you strongly, if you did not get a chance to be present at the lecture in Tucson, you want to get the tape made of his presentation. It was absolutely fascinating. And he talked in part about the research he's been doing over several years on how stress increases brain aging through the effects that the catecholamines have on mitochondrial oxidative stress and neurochemical signaling mechanisms and increased apoptosis. So we talk again about the environment playing or washing over the genes to give rise to the expression of phenotype. And not everyone has the same receptivity to certain messages. Some people have heightened sensitivity. So you might imagine increased cortical output of catecholamines, decreased detoxification due to alteration in MAO detoxification, increased bathing of neurons with the excitatory neurotransmitters, and increased potential for neuroexocytotoxicity. And that means enhanced apoptotic premature cell death in the neurological system. A mechanism is starting to be developed that ties these things together. And it's not just an interesting intellectual mechanism. It leads to different approaches towards both the prevention and remediation of neurochemical problems, not just looking at replacement of a single member of a pathway like a dopamine or like an acetylcholine or an acetylcholine esterase inhibiting drug like tacrine or Cognex. This is a very simple-minded approach to a web-like nervous system that requires multifactorial inputs to give a complex output. We also recognize that the brain from previous discussions is composed not just of neurons, but the glia as well. And glia, coming from the Greek glue-like, is the glue-like substance that kind of holds the brain together, but it's also the brain's immune system. The microglia can act as the mediators of inflammatory response and translate the message of inflammation to that of the brain and also contribute to increased risk to damage to brain aging or neurodegeneration. A very nice review, again in the Annual Reviews of Neuroscience, Volume 22, page 219, talks about microglia as mediators of the production of inflammatory cytokines and how that contributes then to degenerative disease by increasing the risk of oxidative stress of neurons and apoptotic cell death, premature cell death. We recognize that in extreme cases like HIV infection, where the brain can age decades in a matter of months, that this represents the outlying extreme example of an immune upregulation in the brain with increased cytokine and nitric oxide output and uncoupling of neuronal mitochondrial function and, again, the brain on fire, oxidative stress. But there are examples, obviously, of a much less severe nature, which are more chronic in their effect and accumulate damage over decades of living because of alcohol, heavy metal, toxin exposure, chronic stress, suboptimal diet relative to B vitamins and antioxidants, situations with fatty acid insufficiencies, exposure to ionizing radiation, cigarette smoking. I mean, the list goes on and on of conditions that can increase neuronal oxidative stress and mediators of inflammatory conditions in the brain. Recall, if you would, we talked about the paper that appeared in The Lancet some 4 years ago that talked about the very strong statistical relationship between gluten response and early-stage dementia. It's hard to believe, isn't it, that eating wheat over the course of a lifetime, if you have an immune system in your gut that responds to wheat messages as a foe, can translate that message to the glia of the brain and increase brain aging. That's a powerful example of the web-like behavior of the body, that food contains messages. Those messages can be friendly messages or they can be hostile messages. And if a person is eating the hostile message of wheat relative to the immune receptor system of their gut mucosa, then it may translate the message of hostility to the brain through the microglia and increase cytokine, inflammatory mediator output, and increase damage to neurons. So now I'm talking about the brain as an immune body, so-called immune-inducible effects. And of course, we recognize that one of the immune-inducible effects in the brain, other than the constitutive neuronal nitric oxide synthase, is the immune-inducible nitric oxide synthase, or so-called iNOS, immune-inducible nitric oxide synthase, which produces then, upon stimulation from cytokines, the pro-inflammatory Th2 cytokines such as interleukin-1, tumor necrosis factor alpha, interferon gamma, increases then the output of nitric oxide through the upregulation of the effects of iNOS, the inducible nitric oxide synthase. And there's a very nice review that just appeared last month in Molecular Medicine Today, Volume 5, page 225 in 1999, talking about nitric oxide formation in the nervous system. And they say that although it's a very small molecule with a molecular weight, as you know, of just 30, it's a unique informational substance that was first identified as endothelial relaxing factor. This is what Dr. Farhad Murad talked about at our fourth International Symposium on Functional Medicine in Aspen a few years ago, for which he won subsequently the Nobel Prize for his co-discovery of nitric oxide. It was thought to be a protein called EDRF, endothelial relaxing factor, but later was found that this factor was actually a small molecule nitric oxide. As you know, nitric oxide is generated by nitric oxide synthases. You have an endothelial nitric oxide synthase, you have a neuronal nitric oxide synthase, and an immune-inducible iNOS form. This plays a prominent role in controlling a variety of organ functions in the cardiovascular, immune, reproductive, and nervous systems. Inducible nitric oxide synthase, or iNOS, is not normally present in the brain in youth, but it can be detected in the brain after inflammatory, infectious, or ischemic damage in older age individuals, and therefore may contribute in enhanced output to early stage damage to the brain. Brain iNOS seems to contribute to the pathophysiology of many diseases that involve the central nervous system, but the role of iNOS appears to go beyond tissue damage. Brain iNOS might be required for adequate repair following injury or damage, and therefore is part of the normal cell recycling system. However, in the brain, if it occurs as an upregulated factor at too great a rate, then it can lead to irreversible brain damage, and the balance between damage and repair can be shifted towards damage leading to premature loss of neuronal function. What is it that upregulates iNOS? Well, it again is the pro-inflammatory messenger molecules, the cytokines that can influence then as first signal messengers the upregulation of expression of a second signal messenger, nitric oxide, in the nervous system. Some of those molecules, by the way, are produced at the gut level, once again implicating gut, immune, liver, brain connection, a web-like a physiological interrelationship. Looking at The Lancet recently, it was very interesting to see a paper that appeared in Volume 353, page 1414 in 1999, talking about ABO blood groups in children and nitric oxide sensitivity. This is a fairly interesting topic if you recall our discussion with Dr. Peter Diadamo on the Eat for Your Type diet, talking about ABO blood typing and lectin sensitivities and different immune potentiation based upon activities within various genotypes, probably on chromosome 6 related to HLA differences. It's been suggested that there's a relationship between the oxygenation response to inhaled nitric oxide and the ABO blood group system. In 138 adults with respiratory distress system, 67% with blood groups BAB did not respond to nitric oxide, whereas only 27% with blood groups O failed to respond. They suggest a possible linkage between ABO gene locus and influencing the effect of nitric oxide. In reviewing the medical records of 133 children, median age of about 1.6 months, with acute hypoxic respiratory failure or pulmonary hypertension, who all received inhaled nitric oxide at the hospital, The 33 of the children had acute respiratory failure, 7 primary pulmonary hypertension, and 83 developed pulmonary hypertension secondary to congenital heart failure. The median concentration of inhaled nitric oxide delivered was 20 parts per million for a median overall duration of 41 hours. There was no difference between the two groups, O versus B, in baseline ratio of arterial pressure of oxygen. However, in examining the response to iNOS to inhaled nitric oxide, they found a very significant difference between the two blood groups. It suggests that there might be then some difference in the way that immune system messages through nitric oxide are received in differing immune genetic unique individuals. Now, whether this in fact is going to work out to talk about things like the microbiocidal effects in the gastrointestinal tract of nitric oxide and the difference then of risk of growing certain bugs, including Candida albicans, remains to be seen. For instance, it's known in the GI mucosa that nitric oxide output by the GALT, the gut-associated lymphoid tissue, is one of the important sterilizing factors that kills Candida and other potentially parasitic organisms in the gut. So if you had a low nitric oxide response, you might be inclined to a higher opportunistic infection of the gut incidence. Does this tie together with genetic uniqueness? And once we know something about O versus A versus B versus AB types, can it tell us something about what diets and what risk of enteric infection? And why do people that get Helicobacter pylori infection generally tend to be more O's than A's or B's? Are there surface determinants within the receptor sites of mucosa that have to do with both the binding of bacteria as well as the response of the immune system of that individual to those bacteria that then create different environmental conditions in their gut that then influences systemic messages, as I've described, through the immune activation of inflammatory mediators? Clearly, what we're starting to unravel is a much more complex but much more exciting picture of how chronic illness might in fact present itself and where it is initiated by not matching the genes with the environment correctly. We also recognize that there are variations in the genes for mannose-binding lectin, which then create different susceptibilities to meningococcal disease. This was recently described in The Lancet. Remember, if you would, that mannose-binding lectins are cell surface receptors on various cells that then bind to various kinds of external factors, including those that sit on the surface of bacteria and can lead to either adherence and translation of messages or, like the negative and positive poles of magnets, repulsion. The mannose-binding lectin composition is, again, genetically determined, and so individuals with different cell surface determinants, as tied not just through their ABO blood system, but the more complex HLA system, may determine how they respond to certain bacteria, whether they are more infective or less infective, and how that relates to immune activation. This is a very interesting paper because they showed that the mannose-binding lectin pathway was a critical determinant for the meningococcal disease susceptibility, and the genetic variants of mannose-binding lectin could account for a third of all disease cases when examined. So your genotype may determine how at risk you are to certain environmental conditions, including dysbiosis or the exposure to certain bacterial infections that for most people they're immune because their immune system can defend, and for others they're at risk. And then for those individuals, both the lack of exposure and the improvement of their immune system become of importance. Well, we recognize that part of the reaction our gut has as a messenger system will depend on what it's exposed to, but also its state of activation. And just as you can consider immunizing to a viral infection in the whole systemic immunization, you might consider immunizing to something that the gut is exposed to, possibly even an antigen that comes by way of a food allergen. This is an exciting advance in the field of arthritis and rheumatism. As you probably recognize, we've talked about oral tolerance, using the gut to immunize against agents that might then translate messages of inflammation or activation. I'm now quoting from a recent paper in arthritis and rheumatism entitled Modulation by Cytokines of Induction of Oral Tolerance to Type 2 Collagen. And this comes from the recognition that certain types of osteoarthritic collagen-specific disorders, which may be translated through messages that occur from the gut, can be immunized against by administering orally low-dose type 2 oral collagen. Clearly, this has been demonstrated in animals, and Now some limited clinical trials in humans have been encouraging in this regard as well. But what it suggests is that the messaging system that's in the gut can be used to both turn on and turn off immune messages, and that the oral tolerance at low dose, we get low-dose immunization. At high dose, we get activation and inflammation. So the gut may be seen as are the lungs and as the skin and as the systemic immune system as part of our messaging system that can translate messages either to turn on or turn off the response to our environment. So can we utilize low dose of certain substances like sphingomyelin for demyelinating conditions or like collagen for the collagen-specific disorders that will sensitize or activate or neutralize gut responses to these molecules? We even know that environmental factors like visual evoked potentials or through the auditory pathways can have impacts upon the release of messenger molecules. I was very intrigued when I saw the paper in Nature Neuroscience, volume 2, page 382 in 1999, talking about emotional and messenger molecule responses to pleasant and unpleasant music, which correlated with activity in the paralimbic brain regions. They go on to say that these findings suggest that music may recruit neural mechanisms that relate to differing release of messenger molecules, and they differ from pleasant versus unpleasant emotional states related to the music exposure. And I ask myself, given the kind of music that we hear going through Walkmans now and digital discs and headphones into children's ears, what kind of message are they translating to the brain that leads to different messenger molecules that travel through the body? Obviously, this may be considered a drug, I guess in some sense. If a drug modulates physiological function, and physiological function is looked at as by altered molecular milieu, then we might consider some music to be a drug, either a therapeutic drug for producing a state of peace or a drug to produce arousal and hyperactivity, broadening our view of what it is that creates altered state of function. We also know that odors play a big role in modulating nervous system function as well. And it's very interesting, a recent paper that's entitled Molecular Biology of Odorant Receptors goes on to describe the fact that there are more codons that are related to odorant receptors in the mammalian brain than any other single function. Isn't that amazing how we have evolved over the millennia? We still keep in our brain so much of our genes tied to odorant receptors and to the distinguishing of different odors. You might ask in a teleological sense why. In this particular paper, they go on to describe that odorant receptor genes, which form the largest gene family in the vertebrate genome, are there because it was the form of chemoattraction that we used for much of our function in our earlier states as an evolving human, and that we've retained those. We've conserved a lot of those functions, and therefore olfactory pathways play a very principal role in modifying physiological function. And recall, if you would, that the only place that the brain, the central nervous system, directly ties or touches the outside environment is through our nose. And therefore, there are neurons that come from the brain directly to our nasal pharynx, and therefore the external environment can touch directly our brain. And these are lipid-soluble membranes for which lipid-soluble chemicals can work their way up by transport into the brain. This could be toxic fat-soluble molecules, or they could be pleasant smells that elicit different types of neurochemical messages. Another interesting thought about designing an overall environment for an individual that supports their neurological function. And recall, if you would, that the blood-brain barrier, this semipermeable membrane that we thought was helping to defend us against the mistakes that we might have made in our earlier years, is not as impermeable as we thought. In fact, it can become permeable. It can be a leaky brain, just as we have a leaky gut. And in fact, the tissues that make up the gut lumen have a similar embryological developmental history to that of the blood-brain barrier. Therefore, a leaky gut and a leaky brain might be correlated one with the other. And I'm now quoting from a very interesting paper entitled The Cell Biology of the Blood-Brain Barrier. Things that break down the gut barrier may also be breaking down the blood-brain barrier as well, leading to larger molecules than having access to the brain. This could be the pro-inflammatory mediators, the cytokines that relate to upregulation of the inflammation pathways. Of course, this leads to hyperpermeability, both potentially in the gut and in the brain, with increased risk of pathogenesis. And this would be genetically interrelated. Not all people would respond the same and could have very significant clinical implications, says Dr. Alan Miller in a recent paper in Alternative Medicine Review on the pathogenesis, clinical implications, and treatment of intestinal hyperpermeability. So you get a chronic dysbiosis or a food allergy or exposure to a toxic chemical or a stressful situation in your life or an odor that is unpleasant or a noise and sound that is considered hostile. And this can have a dysfunctional set of cellular messages that are translated in your body that create alteration in the barrier defense systems like the gut and the brain, leading to greater leakiness or permeability of middle molecular weight molecules that then activate receptor systems within those tissues that create a different physiological state, a state of altered gene expression and increased risk to dysfunction. And this is all genetically related to that individual's personalized response. Well, that's the theme that we're going to carry on side two with our Clinician of the Month discussion, and we're very pleased to be able to share with you the history of a true renaissance functional medicine practitioner, Dr. Sydney Baker.
As I look over the 18 years and Clinician of the Months that we've had each year, there are a few giants who have stood head and shoulders in this field as pioneers and leaders above the rest of us. One of those people who has been a historic contributor both to the evolution of our field over those 18 years and also to Preventive Medicine Update and now Functional Medicine Update is our clinician this month, Dr. Sydney Baker, who is a master teacher, who is a clinician par excellence, and whose experiences in medicine span a wide variety of activities, ranging from the Peace Corps to the Gassell Institute to informatics at Yale Medical School to the development of what we're now calling euphemistically functional medicine. So I'd like to introduce you all that haven't had the pleasure of meeting Dr. Sydney Baker to Sid. And Sid, I'd like to welcome you once again to Functional Medicine Update. And if you could describe a little thumbnail vignette of your background, starting as a medical student and taking you up to, say, through the Gassell Institute and how those transitions were made.
Well, thank you, Jeff, for the compliments. And I can't ever get on a program with you without returning the compliment. You've kept the bar at an appropriately high level for all of us to aspire to, and have provided the information as well as the inspiration for all of us to try to cleave to a high standard of science in our medical practice. I went to Yale Medical School as a History of Art and Far Eastern History major, and entered medical school with already a bug in my ear that was placed there by my mentor, Dr. Edgar Miller, with whom I spent 3 months in Kathmandu when I was taking a year off between my junior and senior years in college to explore the world a little bit and study history of art and have a little experience with medicine, and as it turned out, in Nepal. Edgar would turn to me during sessions, long lines of patients lined up in little clinics in rural Nepal, and say, as we were finishing with the patient's abscess or tuberculosis or syphilis or leprosy or pneumonia or whatever, he'd say, "Sydney, have we done everything we can for this patient?" And those words echoed in my mind through medical school and still do, as Edgar is with me still as I see patients, and often confronting the most difficult question that we all face in functional medicine is, when do you give up on a certain treatment? When have you wrung the sponge dry when you're confronted with a patient in whom you think there may be a viral problem or a fungal problem or some other problem that requires persistence sometimes in finding the best possible treatment? I found myself in medical school enthralled by the science that was now being taught to me by teachers who really wanted me to learn it rather than graduate students who would hope I would flunk out as a pre-med liberal arts major. But nevertheless, I didn't consider myself that talented as a scientist in medical school. I did win some prizes and did well, let's say, but I also found myself confronting the decision that many of us confront in the early stages of our career, which is thrust upon us invisibly by our resident and intern and junior faculty member teachers, who sort of ask us to decide, you know, whose side are we on here? Are you on the patient's side or you're on our side? I don't want to put too dark a face on it, because I don't mean to say that there's this conspiracy But there is, generally speaking, I think in academic halls, a tendency for the student who is too nice to patients to attract a little bit of disaffection among his colleagues and teachers, that somehow you get better brownie points from quoting the New England Journal and keep carrying a copy of Lancet rolled up in your pocket than you do from spending extra hours, you know, talking with a kid or a mother. I tried to walk that line, but did find myself, and I think still find myself, is more on the side of being a patient's advocate than an advocate of the disembodied science that we all represent, although I think in the end we all try to practice by scientific principles, thanks to the kind of help that Jeff Bland gives us. After I graduated from medical school, I was attracted to neonatology. Yale was pretty strong in that area, but I felt it would be important for me to find out where babies came from. So I spent, after a year of internship in pediatrics, 6 months as a resident in obstetrics and gynecology, and then spent 2 years working in Africa as a Peace Corps volunteer. That wasn't part of the academic tract in those days. It never will be, but it broadened my horizons much more than any fellowship in a particular organ might have. And it was there that I got interested in medical information, because I perceived in rural Chad that some of the decisions made in the Ministry of Health were based on data about what was going on in the countryside that would determine how the country would spend its nickel or 20 cents per capita that it had in its health budget, and whether that money was spent on anti-malarial medicines or penicillin would make a big difference in how soon the nurse in the dispensary out in the bush would run out of the particular medication. I was especially ill-prepared to take any interest in computers, but after coming back to the United States with a new perspective on health gained by working in a different culture again, I finished my chief residency in pediatrics at Yale, and then the dean of Yale, Fritz Redlich, offered me a job in the newborn department of medical computer sciences, which by that time attracted me more than taking care of newborns. And Shannon Brunges, my mentor in that department, was a real computer nerd who had come up through the adrenal gland in academic medicine, and through needs to crunch data, was very adept at Fortran and Hollerith cards and the tools of the trade in the late 1960s, when the computer that we had rented for $250,000 per year from IBM had about maybe 1/100th of the power of the computer that I now take on an airplane when I travel. It was there that Shannon gave me some of the seeds that I eventually tried to grow into thinking about medical data and medical decision making. And especially was grateful to him for many things, but for introducing me to an essay in the book called The Meaning of Meaning, published in 1920 by authors Ogden and Richards, the great linguists of the early part of the 1900s. And in that essay, a physician named Cruikshank said, "Look out, there's a real problem in medicine, and it has to do with language, and it has to do with our tendency to think that diseases are real and that they're kind of things that attack people rather than being concepts that we form about groups of people." And he said in 1920, if we don't fix this problem, pretty soon we're going to get ourselves in a real pickle, because the tendency to reify or to think of diseases as things is really getting us in trouble. It's fine, it doesn't get us in much trouble if we're dealing with measles and chickenpox and broken bones and acute illnesses, but when it comes to chronic illness, this can be a deceptive practice that will deceive ourselves into thinking that we know something about a disease just because we give it a name, such as ulcerative colitis or depression or arthritis. And that essay changed my thinking a lot about what we're doing when we're processing data, that it's much better to process the raw data than some assumptions that are made in the form of a diagnostic label that we give to patients. With that in hand, I, on the faculty at the Yale Medical School, realized that although Yale medical students are very non-competitive, the medical faculty is a very competitive environment. And I found myself being on lots of committees and doing things that weren't as much fun as taking care of patients. I gained 50 pounds and couldn't see my feet anymore and didn't realize they were pointed in the wrong direction. And thought to myself, well, now maybe I should decide on doing something that I enjoy with people that I like working with, doing something that I'm good at. And I went out to become a family practitioner in a health maintenance organization before there were such things by name in New Haven. I had 7 glorious years as a member of a team of specialists who liked to teach me how to do things at 3 o'clock in the morning, because they knew that the next time I was there at 3 o'clock in the morning, I wouldn't have to call them to come in to do it. So I learned how to run a slit lamp and take foreign bodies out of people's eyes and do minor surgery and do office gynecology better than I had learned in my OBGYN training and so on. And meanwhile, took care of children and families and began to have people ask me questions beginning with the word could, such as, could my child's hyperactivity have anything to do with something he's eating? Or could vitamins be helpful for my migraine headaches? And of course, I had learned to answer no to such questions. And it was quite intimidating at first when I realized that one of the reasons that I was inclined to answer no was that I was terrified of the question that might follow a positive response. As if I said, well, I suppose your child's hyperactivity could be related to something he's eating. Then the patient would ask me, well, how do we find out? And I really didn't have a map of that territory. But quite soon in my experience as a generalist, I heard stories from people that made me hesitate strongly from answering so briefly and so negatively on such speculative questions. Because people would tell me stories, and then I began to get some of my own about reactions that people had to foods and inhalants and chemicals that seemed to look a lot like diseases. At least they had the symptoms that we associate with what we call diseases. And similarly, people would tell me outrageous stories about how much taking certain supplements had helped their health. And I had learned in medical school that allergy was mostly fiction and that nutrition was worse than fiction. It was some kind of a hoax. Long about then, I saw a program sponsored by Stanford School of Medicine, Basic Science for Clinicians, in which there were 5 Nobel laureates on the faculty and some serious attempts to teach physicians about basic science. One of the faculty members was Linus Pauling, and meeting him really changed my life. It was a final notch by giving me confidence that even a doctor poorly endowed with scientific skills, in the sense of being a top-notch biochemist, medical student, having majored in biochemistry in college type of person, nevertheless, I could master some of the tools so long as I had a teacher who would explain to me chemistry has to do with how molecules fit together and about the concept of orthomolecular medicine. That is, getting into people before you start drugging them the right molecules in the right amounts for their individual makeup. And, of course, his personality was such a glowing light that it couldn't but affect many of us who came within his reach. A few years later, I was offered the job of the director of the Casale Institute, which was a place interested in the development of children from a biological standpoint. It placed itself somewhat at odds with the prevailing interests of the Yale Child Study Center, from which it had arisen, but had split off to become an independent presence in New Haven, not a transition that's viewed in a friendly way by Yale. In so doing, I alienated myself somewhat from my very true blue Yale-y roots, but I had a chance to explore some of the ideas in an independent setting as I continued practice and was joined by some other doctors, such as Leo Gallen and Bob McClellan, who helped me find my way in this new territory we call functional medicine. And since then, I've been continuing to listen to my patients, and I'm amazed at how much I learn every day by just trying to be a good listener and not giving too ready an answer of no to questions that begin with the word could.
Well, Sid, that was one of the most poignant and extraordinarily rich 15 minutes, a fundamental contributor's life that kind of gives us all some vision as to what it takes to be a pioneer. As you were speaking, I was reminded, actually, and I doubt if you remember this, that this is our 20th anniversary, so to speak. I first met you in 1979 in New Haven, thanks to a student that we shared in common, Matt, who was, I think, working with you as a Yale medical student and had been a senior student of mine the previous year in Washington State. You know, one can talk about coincidences, or one can talk about the warp and weft of how the world works and interconnectedness, but for whatever reason, my being in your office and you taking me to your local county medical society meetings 20 years ago was a major point of note for me as well. And it was 1982 that I then went to work for Linus Pauling and spent a couple of years on sabbatical with him. So it's a very interesting path that we've both traveled. And to hear of the texture of your path, it gives me that warm glow all over. So thanks for sharing that extraordinary experience called your life with us. Just for those of you who are not familiar also, didn't have the pleasure of attending the 6th International Symposium on Functional Medicine,
Dr. Sidney Baker was awarded as the fourth recipient of the Linus Pauling Award for his contributions to functional medicine and takes his place along with Lynn Doman from the Institutes for the Achievement of Human Potential, working with brain injured children in Philadelphia, and Dr. David Jones, our stalwart colleague and fundamental contributor to functional medicine from Ashland, Oregon, and Dr. Kilmer McCulley, the third international award winner of the Linus Pauling Award for his work on homocysteine. So I'm pretty proud of the four recipients of the Linus Pauling Functional Medicine Award, and Dr. Baker being the most recent certainly has kept the tradition alive. Sid, let me, if I can, ask you a question about the whole nature of the evolution of your thought around the gut environment and detoxification. Your book, which is for the health consumer on detoxification, has also slipped over to be highly read by clinicians because it's so beautifully written, as you only can do. You're the master of the metaphor, and the book on detoxification I noticed from Amazon.com the other day is in the top 10,000 books that they sell off of their vast array of books. How did you come into this whole concept of the gastrointestinal ecology and its relationship to toxicity, immune function, and brain chemistry?
I would like to say that it came, well, of course, I wouldn't really like to say, but someone should say that someone got into this through some cosmic intellectual functioning. But as with most things, I slipped in bit by bit through teachings from various corners, including yourself, naturally. And I think Warren Levin was one of the early people who kind of opened up the question of the parasitology in the modern North American context, where I had some credentials already from my Chadian parasitology and my Nepalese parasitology exposure, and thought that I'd left parasites behind when I returned to North America. But now we know that parasites are just one little part of the overall question of the relationship between the germs that live in our gut and the food products that pass through the gut and the body that is surrounded, this tunnel that passes through us. Now that I've had confidence that comes from seeing patients get better when problems of absorption, malabsorption, permeability, dysbiosis, and digestion are treated, I have much more confidence in the more cosmic picture of what this is all about. I think it's helpful sometimes for those of us who were brought up in an orientation toward organ function to stop for a moment viewing the GI tract as just another organ, another focus of specialty, and to think of it in functional terms, that based on the fact that it is the surface across which we transact business with the environment. That is, for the most part, our skin, protective coating, and we do relatively little business with the environment that surrounds us by way of our skin. But rather, we do business on these internal surfaces of our lungs, where we do oxygen and carbon dioxide exchange, and the digestive tract, which is, because of the dirtiness of it, so to speak, the complexity of its contents of food and germs, the immune system's biggest customer. Once we realize that the digestive tract has, say, the surface of a tennis court, and the immune system is in charge of sorting out what good and bad things might be coming from there, it's easy to see that the immune system's preeminence as the focus of modern scientific attention cannot be really processed without acknowledging that what the immune system is doing most of the time is patrolling the complexities of events going on in the gut. Nowhere is this seen, I think, more vividly than in the metabolic adventures of children with autism, which has become a particular interest of mine, where one sees the third leg of the triangle that I'm drawing for you, which is the gut as one part of the triangle, the immune system as its biggest customer, and the central nervous system, which is the immune system's partner in two fundamental processes, two fundamental functions, to use the right word, of the organism, which is to perceive the environment and then to remember what you've perceived so you can function again when it comes around again. This business of the immune system and the brain somehow being connected to each other, which I say that with a wry smile on my video here, you're getting an audio signal, but if you could see the video, why, I can't refer to the new field of psychoneuroimmunology without kind of a sardonic feeling, because I think it's a matter of first principles that the immune system and the central nervous system function together really as a unit from the get-go as the partners in the organism's efforts to take in, to perceive, to get on board an image or images of the environment. These images are conveyed to our brain through our senses and to our immune system, things that we call antigens or idiotypes or pictures of the molecules that are taken in. And then we remember these pictures through mechanisms of the brain which are functionally not that different, even on the anatomical basis. And then we respond by doing something that's common language to people in the central nervous system, immune system, called recognition. Some people have a hard time processing signals in these various levels, and I think children with autism express clinically the most profound difficulties in processing signals. And if we view their troubles from this functional perspective, and within this triangle that unites these three functions in the body of digestion and the immune function and central nervous system function, then I think we do better than doing what I learned in medical school, which is pick an organ, name what's wrong with it, and then blame the name for the patient's problem and say, I know what your child has. He has autism. That's what's causing the trouble. And my insistence is that, of course, that it's the name of the problem, not the cause.
Well, I know that you've been meeting recently with a group on this whole autism web-like thinking, the DAN group, names that we're very familiar with, like Dr. Bernard Rimlin and Dr. Woody McGinnis and Kelly Dorfman, a dietitian who has been actively involved in children's brain chemistry and nutrition, and of course Bill Crook is a father of this whole field, and Bill Shaw, and we had a Clinician of the Month interview with Dr. Michael Lyon, who from Canada was talking about his work with ADHD children and the relationship between the gut-liver-brain connection. So it seems as if we're pulling together a consortium of high-level thinkers and clinicians to really put some attention to this. Do you think this is going to push the envelope a little bit for traditional medicine to look more seriously at this whole connection?
Yes, and of course the secretin business and its publicity on TV has done a lot to refocus people's attention below the collarbone. When I was in training in the 1960s, I still remember professors who taught me that the cause of autism was in the child's mother and that the mother was to blame. Fortunately, thanks to Bernie Rimlin and his book published in 1964, 1965, there was a major shift in beliefs of the community so that no one really thinks that anymore, although I still hear from parents who have seen one or another practitioner who makes references to things that engender a memory of this guilty feeling that was thrust upon parents. So it hasn't quite disappeared, but it's almost disappeared from our culture and has been displaced by a feeling that the blame lies somewhere between the child's ancestors, that is, there's genetics involved, and the child's brain, but nothing certainly below the collarbone. The effectiveness of injection of a so-called gastrointestinal hormone into children and its positive results has really opened the door to the kind of thinking that began, at least for me, at the DAN meeting in 1995 in Dallas, when a group, including the people you mentioned, and Carl Reichelt, and Paul Shattuck, and Gene Stubbs, and Rosemary Waring, and others, got together to brainstorm this thing in the most wonderful spirit. I mean, it really evoked the same kind of spirit that we have in the functional medicine meetings, where there's really a kind of teach me what you know and share with me feeling, rather than you talk until I find something wrong that you say and then I'll shoot you down, which is often the tenor of academic debate and discussion. So this was a very open meeting where we tried to crystallize a picture of what was going on. It turns out to be a picture very compatible with the precepts of functional medicine that applies to many, many problems. The boundaries of this difficulty in the triangle that I described are certainly not defined within the clinical spectrum of autism at all, but extends into chronic fatigue syndrome and lots of the other stuff that we encounter as clinicians. But the nice thing about the meeting was that eminent immunologists such as Sudhir Gupta, with both feet planted firmly in mainstream immunology, as one of the leaders of that field, could openly discuss with people who are peptide chemists and clinicians, and Bill Shaw with his interest in organic acids, what this is all about and how it all fits together, which I tried to portray in a little map on page 8 of the protocol that came out of that meeting, which is available for Autism Research Institute. I asked at our most recent meeting outside of Philadelphia in Cherry Hill last October, I asked the DAN group, or the remnants of the clan that were assembled, plus some newcomers, if anybody had some new insights that we should use to make the picture a little bit clearer or add to some of the elements that fit into that picture of an immune susceptibility, something to do with chronic infection, something definitely to do with gastrointestinal problems and fungal infections and detoxification problems. And the one addition came from our friend Wayne Mattson, who's been looking at mitochondrial disturbances in these kids and pointed out that there's something to do with fried mitochondria or oxidatively damaged mitochondria that I think belongs in the picture. But otherwise, the picture that we formed has been coalescing so that I guess I've learned more about this than any other subject I've tried to learn about in a short period of time. It's really thrilling to be involved in something where the picture is coming into focus as quickly as it is. Still, there's some pretty big unanswered questions that are, I think, exemplified by not having much of a clue of how secretin works, but at least we know we're in the right ballpark. And actually, we got some hits in that ballpark. The clinical effectiveness of intervention is startling in some children, and what we don't understand is why we strike out with some other kids.
I'm reminded, as you're speaking, of what I consider the mind-opening paper that appeared in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. I think it was 1977, out of the National Institutes of Mental Health. Principal author was a gentleman by the name of Zitteroo, that was talking about exorphins and their impact on behavior and brain chemistry. I'd never heard exorphins used. It was a term coined by that group that was talked about partial hydrolysates of casomorphine, so it'd be peptides derived from milk protein and also from partial hydrolysates of gluten, showing endorphin-like activities in bioassays, and they suggested that these partial hydrolysates in the gut, if absorbed across the GI, could influence in receptor sites and influence behavior and might account for some of the schizophrenia that's seen in gluten-sensitive individuals that is exacerbated by consuming wheat. And that opened my mind very much to this whole concept, and read about the Hemmings work and the symposium that were held in England over many years. And then in 1993, this article by H.O. Hunter, the clinical immunologist in England, in The Lancet, entitled "Intrametabolic Disorders or Food Allergy?" In which he talks once again about gut connection to the immune system, to the brain. And it just seems like this web-like thinking of physiology, as evidenced by your work with the Dan group, is finally starting to come of age.
Mimicry, I think, is one of the words that is most helpful to keep in our vocabularies when we think about these things. It's a phenomenon that occurs all throughout nature as creatures learn self-defense and predation from dressing up like other creatures. And at the molecular level, we're finding that there are molecules that are dressed up that look very much like the molecules we're using to send messages in the immune system, the central nervous system, and elsewhere. The most startling example of this was presented by Alan Friedman from Johnson & Johnson at the October Dan meeting in Cherry Hill, when he described the discovery and the identification in the urine of children with autism, these peptides, these 8 amino acid compounds, that now, thanks to the technology available at J&J, which has deep pockets for this kind of application, thanks to that technology can identify down to amino acid sequence in a very short time basis, so that within months or days they can do what Carl Reichelt in Norway has been working out over a period of years in his similarly inspired research. So what does he find? He finds, for example, a molecule in the urine of autistic children called dermorphin, which has the exact same structure, is the same molecule, so to speak, as the South American poison dart frog toxin, which if you dip your arrow in it and shoot the monkey down, the monkey falls down dead, and if you lick the frog, you trip your brains out for a day, and then you, to be polite, defecate your brains out for the next 3 days. This extremely interesting toxin is found in the urine of children. Where does it come from? It comes from the casein molecule as a product, as you were just saying, of incomplete digestion and assimilation of this mischievous mimic into the body's chemical economy. The next thing is, one of these peptides that they found, which was similar to the dermorphin, they said, well, here's a peptide, it didn't get digested, can we find an enzyme that will digest it? And they searched the literature to find an enzyme that matches the terminal sequences of amino acids in terms of its proclivities, and they find that the CD26 enzyme, as it's called, is just the thing. Well, what is the CD26 enzyme? One thing that it is the surface marker on CD26 lymphocytes. We look in our database that I'm keeping on the autistic children, and 57% of our autistic children have abnormal elevations of their CD26 lymphocytes. I've been asking, I asked the author of Molecules of Emotion, Candace Pert. I'm looking forward to meeting her in Tucson because I haven't heard from her back what this means. What does it have to do with that we have children with elevations in CD26 lymphocytes and we have in their gut a peptide that wants a CD26 enzyme to be digested, which presumably the kids are lacking? That's a presumption that I'm making. I'm not blaming it on anybody else. So this is the kind of fertile territory that we've wandered into with all of this stuff happening that should, in the next few years, thanks to now the joining of the party of people like Alan Friedman and J&J and others with both the intellectual and the technical tools to pursue these things, a real feast of information that will be, I think, soon a much greater help to clinicians. We're taking care not just of autistic kids, but kids with other problems that are in the realm of difficulties in perception and organization of thinking. So it's a trip.
Sid, I want to thank you for being our tour director on this trip. It's been an extraordinary voyage that we've just been on for the last 35 minutes through the last 30-plus years of medical evolution, and I think it sets us right at the cornerstone of the new millennium, where functional thoughts may come into medicine. And you've always said, well, you know, functional medicine might be just called good medicine. And whatever the term is, it seems we're at that threshold. And I thank you for both your historic contributions and for what you've done to stimulate the rest of us for doing our best work.
Well, if I can return the thanks from all of the listeners, who I think would like each one of them to thank you over and over again for enlightening them and entertaining them and making long car trips tolerable and inspiring. Our thanks go to you for being a leader in this field, Jeff, and a good friend.
Thanks so much, Sid, and we'll talk to you real soon.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Once again, we thank Dr. Baker so much and are so privileged to have him as the fourth award recipient of the Linus Pauling Functional Medicine Award that was awarded to him at the 6th International Symposium on Functional Medicine in Tucson. And by the way, I would greatly urge you once again, if you did not attend the meeting, to get a copy of the tapes of Dr. Baker's workshop on rhythms in medicine and how that relates to function and this whole concept of periodicity and using the right thing at the right time. It's really grace in medicine, and Dr. Baker did a marvelous job in his workshop in teaching us about gracefulness and being in rhythm and being in synchrony with our environment and how important that is. So certain things at certain times, they work better than if they are given at the wrong time. I think that message of being in the dance of life and being in rhythm is a very powerful message that you'll get from Dr. Baker's workshop. You recall we were talking about breakdown of barriers, the skin or the lung barrier or the gastrointestinal mucosa or the blood-brain barrier, and how that can be in part triggered by genetic susceptibilities and the exposure to environmental triggers. It's interesting to note that the breakdown of intestinal lumen and increased leaky gut syndrome is also associated with liver disease, as you might expect, as there is a greater release of toxic molecules that come from the gut to the liver, that the liver then upregulates its detoxification function, and the Kupffer cells, which are the embedded leukocytes within the liver, the immune system of the liver, then undergoes its upregulation, and as such, more oxidants are produced and more inflammatory mediators are produced, and that may, again, in susceptible individuals, increase the risk to liver injury. This is reported in a nice series of papers in the European Journal of Gastroenterology and Hepatology, volume 11, page 401, 1999. So when you're dealing with individuals that have hep C infections or have hepatitis or cirrhosis, you really need to concern yourself in a comprehensive treatment program, not just with the individual infectious agent, but also with the milieu of the immune system, which may be triggered in its heightened state of alarm through a gut dysfunction. And so think about gut balancing as well as the liver balancing when you have a patient who has liver involvement, liver inflammation or cirrhosis or hepatitis. We also recognize that the gut is a brain, and the brain is a gut. I know that sounds probably for many of you a little bit taking the brain off of its pedestal or putting the gut on a pedestal that it doesn't deserve. But what has been recognized is that the enteric nervous system and its interrelationship with neurotransmitters, that the brain has neurotransmitters that are gut hormones and the gut has neurotransmitters that are brain hormones, and they intercommunicate one with the other. There's a wonderful review on this entitled The Enteric Nervous System and Regulation of Intestinal Motility, talking about the interrelationship between gut and brain through this chemical signaling system. I think anyone that's ever had nervous anxiety to stand up and give a speech certainly is aware of this. You know that the brain can control your gut very quickly. If you've ever been thrust into a very fearful situation, you know that immediately, without any voluntary control, your gut might be telling you something about fear. This particular relationship, if in a state of chronic stress, can produce a hyper-irritable bowel and can continue to aggravate and exacerbate problems with regard to CIBS, chronic irritable bowel syndrome. And so we recognize that there are a whole series of gut functions that are tied to the brain, and there are a whole series of brain functions that may be tied to the gut. This ties us back to a wonderful and a very provocative paper that was authored by a variety of colleagues headed by Dr. Andrew Wakefield from the Inflammatory Bowel Disease Study Group, University Department of Medicine and Histopathology at the Royal Free Hospital and School of Medicine in London, entitled Ileolymphoid Nodular Hyperplasia, Nonspecific Colitis, and Pervasive Developmental Disorders in Children. As you recall, we briefly quoted this paper before, but I think it's of significant enough interest that we need to state it again, that this was a study of children who had autism and developmental disorders who were referred to a pediatric gastroenterology unit with a history of normal development followed by loss of acquired skills, including language, together with diarrhea and abdominal pain. So they came to this gastroenterology department for GI distress, having nothing to do with being looked at for their developmental neurological problems. However, these good investigators started to piece the puzzle together and say that the onset of these behavioral symptoms was associated by the parents with measles, mumps, and rubella vaccination in 8 of the 12 children, with measles infection in one child and otitis media in another. All 12 children had intestinal abnormalities ranging from lymphoid nodular hyperplasia to aphthoid ulceration. Histopathology showed patchy chronic inflammation in the colon in 11 children and reactive ileolymphoid hyperplasia in 7. They went on to show that these children often had increased excretion of methylmalonic acid, indicating malabsorption of vitamin B12, and therefore as a consequence of altered gastrointestinal ileolymphoid function and mucosal boundary defense, they may have been malabsorbing certain nutrients and absorbing other kinds of potentially toxic molecules. The conclusion of the study was that they showed an associated gastrointestinal disorder and developmental regression in a group of previously normal kids, many of whom went on to express what is classically called autism. And this was generally associated with environmental triggers, of which MMR, mumps, measles, rubella vaccination, appeared to be one of those environmental triggers. But also food intolerance was seen very commonly in these children as well, including sensitivity to gluten. Now, we're going to continue on this theme in next month's Functional Medicine Update, and this is kind of a first-level education to take the gut to the brain in these genetically susceptible kids that we will then go on to much more detail, talking about G-protein signaling and how, in fact, the mechanism of this relationship, which seems very bizarre, how an MMR vaccination with genetically susceptible kids could affect the gut that affects brain chemistry that then produces the symptoms of autism. I mean, that's not an obvious connection that most gastroenterologists, neurologists, hepatologists, or pediatricians would probably make. In a follow-up paper appearing in The Lancet, this is entitled Ileolymphoid Nodular Hyperplasia, Nonspecific Colitis, and Pervasive Developmental Disorders in Children, the work of Kolan and Balanti and Sabra from the International Center for Interdisciplinary Studies on Immunology, Department of Pediatrics at Georgetown University School of Medicine, went on to say that they noted a striking appearance of ileolymphoid nodular hyperplasia in patients with non-IgE-mediated food allergy who presented with asthma, atopic dermatitis, and ADHD, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. In their study, ileolymphoid nodular hyperplasia, or an upregulation of the immune system of the gut as a consequence of the reaction that person is having to their environment, was the hallmark lesion of the gastrointestinal tract, allowing entry of antigens across the inflamed mucosa of the bowel as a result of the reactive inflammatory response in the adjacent lymphoid tissue of Peyer's patches in patients with non-IgE-mediated food allergy. And again, this is The Lancet, Volume 352, page 234, following up from Dr. Wakefield's observations. Most recently, another paper has appeared showing that children who get the measles often have this defect, which creates then this chronic upregulation of their immune system. and is seen in nodular lymphoid hyperplasia in the gut that's associated with altered brain chemistry. This may explain in part why secretin has been helpful, because it influences the morphology and function of the gut in such a way as to restore more normal barrier defense, and we'll talk more about that in next month's Functional Medicine Update. And it may also help us to understand better in some children the origin of ADHD and hyperkinesis. I was very intrigued when I read the review article in The Lancet, volume 351, page 429, entitled Attention Deficit Hyperactivity Disorder and Hyperkinetic Disorder, in which they go through the diagnostic criteria, the epidemiology, and the treatment. And they go on to say that there are two primary modalities for treatment of ADHD, pharmacological with stimulant medications and behavioral with a variety of psychosocial interventions. They do not talk about metabolic nor web-like functional interaction of the gut with the nervous and the immune system at all. They don't even cite any of these papers, but rather they talk about trials with clonidine and various types of central nervous system active drugs and psychotherapy or behavioral therapies, rather than looking at some of the metabolic relationships that we've been talking about in Functional Medicine Update for the last several years. So a new paradigm is emerging. It's going to take us beyond this genotype fixed deterministic model of disease. It's going to take us into the recognition that there are many phenotypes that can emerge out of the genotype, that we have pleomorphic genes that can be expressed in different ways, and that for some individuals that carry certain types of histocompatibility locus antigen determinants on their genes, their risk to certain environmental responses are higher than others, and triggering those through certain substances may then precipitate disorders that can appear in infancy, childhood, or in later adulthood. And by knowing those triggers, knowing the genotype, and modifying the outcome of function, we might be able to restore for that individual high-level function, recognizing that for them, what is normal may be very different than that for another individual. When I say normal, I mean optimal. And certainly when I look at the ADHD description in The Lancet, I recognize it's the vestige of an old model. It's a model that says when it's broken, we'll move in to fix it by changing the symptom cluster, not looking at the locus of where the origin of this breakdown in the web of physiology occurred. We'll continue this theme that Dr. Baker has brought us to recognize over his years of teaching and research and outcome studies when we move on in the next level of G protein signaling next month in Functional Medicine Update. Thanks for being with us.
Functional Medicine Update is copyrighted by HealthCom International Incorporated of Gig Harbor, Washington, USA. Reproduction in any form is prohibited.